it's great Steve's come down to do this. But also, it's just to say that the Liverpool group have been involved in stuff a bit longer than us, maybe, what, 5 or 6 years, yeah. As they are, yeah. So they've got a bit of heritage, and we're very interested in making links across the country with other radical history groups, so we've got contacts in London and Liverpool and Leeds and one or two other places as well. So anyway, I'm just going to hand over to Steve now, really, and let you get on with it.
Right, before I start, just to give me a bit of a guide, can anyone give us the right time?
35.
See? I'm in a port city to discuss talking about time, and already there are a number of time clones in the audience. Because it's time, in particular, that is shaping our work back in Liverpool. We originally started off our project, or our concept, it came out of the Dockers dispute, 1995. We had an idea, because we were involved with writing the film on the Dockers with Jimmy McGovern. And we had an idea to take that forward then, to make a film about Liverpool seafarers in the 1950s, sailing to New York and what they were bringing back with them. But very soon, with our involvement in the Dockers and with our involvement of seafarers, we came to realise that there is something very different about living in a port city. Something very different indeed. And we would argue that the bigger the port, the bigger the difference. Difference in relation to its own nation state. So, our work presently is framed by why Liverpool, Naples and Marseille have more in common with each other than they do with their respective nation states. And I would suggest as well that within that we have Cardiff, Bristol and any of the other, London, any of the other major ports in Great Britain, United Kingdom. What we believe are the major differences within a port city. We came across an article that was written in 1967 by a social historian, E.P. Thompson. And it was called Time and Work Discipline. 1967 he wrote it. And what Thompson did in that article, he posed 5 major themes that needed to be answered. He described a pre-industrial work rhythm that people had, whether it was agriculture or anything else, before the transition to an industrial society. And what Thompson described as that pre-industrial work pattern was one of alternate bouts of intense labour followed by bouts of intense idleness. And then he posed this question, whether or not that could be defined as a natural work rhythm. He then posed whether or not that natural work rhythm had ever gone away in the great ports of the United Kingdom. And in particular, he stressed that that natural work rhythm was also congruent with the body rhythm of women in particular. And he makes the point that women would be in the forefront of fighting any imposition of industrial time. Now, we took that away, that article. We discussed it amongst ourselves, and we still continue to discuss it. Because 3 years ago, I was introduced to a person who I write with now, Tony Whaley, who was tutored down at Ruskin College, Oxford. He's an ex-seafarer, and his PhD that he wrote at Ruskin is probably one of the few bodies of work that goes into work and port cities, in particular working time. Because Tony's thesis described casualism on the docks, which for everyone, the way I was brought up, my trade union background would say casualism was bad, casualism meant labour casualties, etc., etc., etc. Tony Whaley did not accept that, and he in particular described the 1947 revolts that took place in Liverpool, Cardiff, Bristol and London, whereby there was a head-on resistance to decasualising casual work on the docks. Now, for me personally, coming from my tradition, I found that very, very difficult to deal with and to comprehend. Until 2 years ago, I started looking at those revolts from 1945 to 1947. But when we started to compare them, we found that similar revolts were taking place within the British Empire, particularly in the great port cities of Lagos, Mombasa, Port Elizabeth, where dock workers and seafarers were refusing as well to be decasualised. And the reason that they were refusing to be decasualised was they saw and lodged a complaint with the United Nations that any other work other than casual work was slave labour and forced labour. So we had the position from 1945 to 1947 where the labour arm of the United Nations, the International Labour Organization, is going through a series of contortions over what is free labour and unfree labour. Because if what the workers of the British colonies were saying was right, the casualism was free labour, then that must also apply to what was going on in the port cities of Britain and also in New York and New Orleans. So they were caught in this continuing dilemma, and it bore itself out in a major dispute that occurred in November 1947. And that was when a group of seafarers and dockers from Liverpool, seafarers and dockers from Bristol, seafarers and dockers from Southampton, walked off and refused to handle the ship that was due to sail, the Empress of Canada. Now, the first demand from the passengers within the first hour of the dispute, the first demand from the passengers who were stranded on that ship was that they'd run out of caviar. They had run out of caviar. And of course, what we began to realise was why that ship had been singled out was it was full of the creme de la creme of world royalty who had been in London to have a trial run of the royal wedding that took place a fortnight later between Queen Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh. That dispute went on for a day and a half, and it was finally resolved. and the men went back to work. But the ship still couldn't sail because the tide had turned. So they went back to work and they were put back on full pay plus 12 hours overtime. So in a nutshell there, we have this sense of agency and planning and self-activity that this group had come up with. And it actually used the tidal patterns as a pressure point and a power point against the shipping owners. And that dispute broke out because the seafarers who were working that ship were told that they would have to go on to permanent contracts of employment. Now, a month later, the Ministry of Labour had to issue a statement. And part of that statement says that for seafarers and dockers, their illusions of freedom have got to be seen to be illusory. So this throws up another point to add to this debate that we need to have around free labour and unfree labour. Now, when I spoke about the British Empire before, if I can just take you back, the years before the Second World War, within the great port cities of West Africa, a freedom movement called Negritude had developed. Frantz Fanon, Senghor, Antoine Cabral. Negritude was what Jean-Paul Sartre called anti-racist racism. This celebration of blackness. Now what's interesting, within that development of Negritude, Fanon, Cabral and Senghor refused to accept the word proletarian. What they accepted instead was the lumpen. No proletarian, just the lumpen. Now, the lumpen proletariat, as defined by Karl Marx, he defined them as a raggedy proletariat. And the reason why he defined them as raggedy is that at that time, raggedy meant irregular. It's similar to the birth of ragtime before jazz. Ragtime was given the name because it was an irregular musical rhythm. So, the development of Negritude and the anti-colonial struggle was based on the lumpen classes, as Fanon called them. He would not go near the proletariat per se, because he said skilled labour, what the proletariat stood for, was of no use whatsoever. In fact, skilled labour was a hindrance to the anti-colonial movement, more than a help. Now, this throws up some very interesting points that we're hoping to develop in our next work. It throws up what we believe is the terms of labour. What I mean by that is that E.P. Thompson in 1967, when he wrote Time and Work Discipline, he made the point that he believed, come what may, industrial society would occur. And he named three particular reasons that would make sure it would occur. The influence of Methodism, the influence of nationalism, and the influence of what Chancellor called Stalinism. Because he said all three of them helped to create an inward notation of time. The time was digested, and ultimately the battles over time would decrease and the industrial society would have won out. Now, I believe Edward Thompson was very true, what he said. But we would add to that, that skill labour, by its very nature, is male, exclusionary, and most importantly, it is time served. So already, once you enter a skill, you become a time-served tradesman. And by becoming a time-served tradesman, you become time-disciplined. The areas that don't, we would suggest, is the areas of dock time, as we call it, time of the dock, not time of the clock. Because dock labour, seafaring labour, and I think it will be very, very interesting to try and have a discussion around this issue about what could have taken place in Cardiff and Bristol. Dock time is not governed by the clock. When you turned up at a call stand looking for work, that was governed on the tidal patterns of the day. Liverpool's tidal patterns are some of the most irregular in Europe. So the time that you would attend for work would be totally irregular as compared to a normal factory 6 to 2, 2 to 10, 10 to 6. And what we would suggest is linked to that is, why is it that port cities are matriarchal societies? We've done a major study of Naples, Marseille, Liverpool, New York, New Orleans, and Boca Docks in Argentina. Now, 2 years ago, we were being told that matriarchal societies in port cities were there because of the men being away at sea. But long after the ships have gone, there is still a matriarchal society within those port cities. Liverpool's female to male breakdown is 52% to 48%. It was the last census, 2004. 1880, 80% of the poor who were imprisoned of Liverpool were women. Now, these are, we believe, very, very important historical points. But we would suggest, just the way Edward Thompson suggested about the inward notation and the time discipline, the areas that don't and have still not accepted that time and work discipline will be matriarchal societies. And the point that we make is this, is that up to 1600 calendar time in Great Britain, is based on a lunar calendar. Because from the 11th century to the 15th century, you had seen the development of major maritime states. So the lunar calendar was governed by the star of the sea, the Stella Maris, who is the Virgin Mary. And that is why in any of the great port cities today, you will still see her iconography and symbolism. Now, the lunar calendar was based on full moon to full moon. That is what governs the world's tidal patterns. But what it also does, that is also the exact same cycle that E.P. Thompson was hinting at in his article, which is the length of a woman's menstrual cycle. The two are identical. And this is why when we've looked at our own history in Liverpool, we would debate, we don't accept that some of the radical history that has dealt with the Puritans and that tradition, we would not accept that that is progressive. We would see it as regressive, because one, it removes the matriarch from society, puts the patriarch in, and that was the foundation of the Protestant Reformation. Now, the two other points that I'll deal with there, because I was going to go into why port cities are always rhythm cities. In particular, there hasn't been a musical revolution in the world that has not emanated from one of the great port cities. Whether it's Liverpool, and please don't ask me about the Beatles. No. Whether it's Liverpool punk scene or Liverpool dance scene in the 80s, what you've had in Bristol, Massive Attack and Blue Lines, rock and roll coming out of New Orleans, rhythm and blues coming out of New Orleans and New York. River cities are always rhythm cities. And we would suggest that is because their sense of time, their control of their own time, allows for a play ethic rather than a work ethic. Because controlling your own time, I would strongly argue, is the ultimate level of freedom. Now, we do have to be careful when we're discussing this, especially in today's economic climate, that there is a resurgence of casual labour without the what I would call the safety net of what was built in to casualism from 1930 onwards. And what's interesting, when we studied that issue of casualism on the docks or at sea, the only way the government could implement a decasualisation system was by what was called three on the hook, three on the book. That's what it was called. Dockers, 3 days on the docker's hook, 3 days on unemployed benefit. So people could pick and choose when, where, and how they would work. Because ultimately, you were in control of your own time. Now, E.P. Thompson back in 1967, and he's still the only historian who has ever gone near this issue, Edward Thompson says that we are now looking at a system of work where casualism no longer means casualty. Because historically, our history in this country and elsewhere has always said casualism on the docks and at sea was degrading, it was this, it was that. We believe that there's another story to that. And that if you are part of a philosophy that celebrates the right to work, you see within the world of work a morality, then you would attack casualism. And you would impose on casualism a view that would be quite distorted in reality. The final point would be, earlier on in the discussion I spoke about the United Nations, the Charter of Freedom, Charter of Human Rights. Their labour arm from 45 to 47 trying to define what was free and unfree labour. That issue has been resurrected again by, I think it was another student of E.P. Thompson, a fellow called Douglas Hay, who's written about the master servants, what masters were, what servants were always tied to their masters. Now he's written it from 1550 to 1955. And Douglas Hay comes to the same conclusion, that in fact the central point of unfree labour is, one, you are where the individual is unable to control their own sense of time, and two, they are unable to move in and out of jobs, so there is a restriction on labour mobility. So basically, what we could be looking at today is that all those forms of past labour that have been reified by us all, really, skilled labour, is nothing but another form of industrial feudalism. That you are tied by skill to the job. You are tied by skill to the factory. Very, very similar to being yoked and bridled by the land during feudalism. And that's the point that Douglas Hay makes. It's been very interesting, the response that we have received to some of the ideas that we're now starting to put out. But we take heart from, about a month ago, England played a friendly football match with France. And halfway through the second half, the French made a substitution. And all you could hear, that substitution, was the whole eruption of the French crowd in boos, whistles and jeers. I thought that the French coach was taking off one of the star players. But it had nothing to do with that. It was the fact that the person who was coming on plays for Olympique Marseille, a port city, who are loathed more by the French than anybody else. Like Liverpool is not England, Marseille is not France, Naples is not Italy, and I would hope tonight we can also say that Bristol is in England. Thank you. So am I right or wrong?
to ask, have you made any comparisons between, say, Liverpool and other football cities around that town, like Newcastle or Portsmouth, for example, or how they do with a public experience?
First thing we'd say is that time and work discipline will be prevalent within ports that have a military history. But the fact that you are a part of a military apparatus would suggest that you are already time disciplined. You obey, you defer to authority. Portsmouth and Plymouth, we haven't found anything suggests that there was any form of resistance there. Southampton, major resistance, and Glasgow, part resistance. But if, you see, I think a lot of it depends on, and we go back to the celebration of the lumpen proletariat. The class who, he was a great oppositionist to Karl Marx, Max Stirner, called the class of the refusal to work. And so we would say that any port city that has a predominance of unskilled labour will have this attitude towards time and a rejection of time and work discipline. And that is predominantly the great ports, because there's always been a major imbalance of unskilled to skill. And what I found in my trade union history, I represented up to 2003, 1800 of the most anarchic, most ill-disciplined and the sheer bone idol of Liverpool postal workers. And three times, from 1995 to 1998 to 2001, we were threatened with closure. And the reason that they were going to close Liverpool was, and there was four of us who were the main negotiators, was that their work study people and time and motion people said, all the reports they gave us, there is a good work rate in Liverpool when they are there. The problem is, they spend that much time away from the job. And we just said, well, can't you take a joke, you know? But again, if you applied that work rhythm to what Edward Thompson was writing about, the alternate bouts of labour and idleness, well, I think that is endemic in any work establishment. You know, whether it's, we call it in Liverpool, a job or not, the blow, the early dart. We've never seen work as the be all and end all. But the what we had difficulty with the closure was that the further inland we went, the more productive those offices were. And I think this is the what I'd call a rupture of class, in that there is a totally different attitude to work in a port city than there is in a mining town or a oil mill town. Or because it's funny, we were continually compared to Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, whose levels of productivity they had no levels of absenteeism and stuff like that. It was always hung over our heads.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about what Marx said about resistance to work and how that's been interpreted. But it seems to me that the big secret or the big embarrassment of a lot of, like, I don't know, Marx's stuff about work and discipline and work discipline is that lots of forms of struggle in capitalism are kind of deceptive, like strike or, you know, obviously closure and all sorts of other things as well. But one of the areas that a lot of the left historically didn't want to go into the area was resistance to work. And Marx talks about ideas about lazy peasants and lazy kind of colonial workers, and he kind of makes fun of it, saying, you know, the fact that people didn't want to be proletarianised, didn't want to end up in a mine or a factory in the colonies. I think he talks about the Caribbean, was that they were kind of resisting, like, work discipline, and that was interpreted by the British as laziness. I just thought you might want to comment about this kind of thing where Marx was talking about that kind of stuff, but after the time of Marx, the left completely, well, pretty much ignore resistance against work as a struggle against capitalism, as part of class struggle.
Well, to make it clear, really, I do not come from a Marxist tradition. Mm. Never have done. Coming from Liverpool, the tradition is far more anarchist-based, libertarian, and so Karl Marx to me, because when you read his work on the British Empire, he calls levels of work, he does define groups of workers as being backward. So you have to pass through this stage of time where those workers will mature and they will become class conscious. For me, Karl Marx was right, only ever wrote about one group of workers, and that was the only group of workers he ever met, the artisan class. Our reading of what Marx was writing about was, what he was viewing from 1840 onwards was a huge revolt against work, predominantly from the unskilled sections of labour. And that terrified him.
That was it.
And that terrified him. Because if you are and produce a philosophy that celebrates work, what are you going to do to the people who refuse to work? We're then led down this road of labour camps, forced labour re-education camps that have blighted this world over and over and over again. So I don't see Karl Marx as a liberator, I see him as an encloser, because he was a philosopher of that gave a definition of the factory unit and the liberatory. If you become class conscious, you will be able to take another step forward to the promised land, which will still take you back to the enclosed factory. So I'm far more interested in, if you like, when Marx was writing, the people who were attacking him, and what were they attacking him for? Max Stirner called him, this is another phase of the Protestant Reformation, industrial Protestantism, Stirner called him. The same label was applied to Lenin with the Bolsheviks. And that label was applied by the Kronstadt seafarers who rose against the Soviet state. for exactly the same reasons that Liverpool had gone off in 1911, Bristol had gone off a year later, Cardiff had gone off. Now, we cannot, I don't believe, you can't separate what's going on in Liverpool, Cardiff, New York from 1910, 1912, and what's going on in Kronstadt 9 years later. I just don't think you can separate them, because they are all revolts against work and revolts against authority. So I'm far more interested in the people who disagreed with Karl Marx and why, and who saw him as a celebrant of work, that philosophy. And predominantly, they were the anarchist tradition from Stirner, Proudhon, from that type of tradition, who did not see work as the central human factor. Because that's the other thing, you see, that we are led to believe that work is perfectly natural. That man only becomes, because it's always men, remember, it's never women. Man can only become man through the products of his labour, which I think is absolute nonsense. Absolutely nonsense. It's more religious and Christianic, that version, than anything else. As you go back to St. Paul, those who will not work will not eat. So it's, that's where I think we should place Karl Marx, in a long line of religious philosophers, rather than anything else. Come on.
I take your point about time and work and everything, but a lot of these edgy cities, I got your book, they are also melting pots, and there's a lot of ethnic mix, and everything brews up and something comes out of this. I mean, this is what happens with culture and music and everything. In Liverpool, for example, which you were I'm also interested in what you're saying about Marseille, because there was an article in History Today last month about when the Nazis occupied France. They hated the place. There was a district in Marseille that was just, they just couldn't handle it, because there was prostitutes, pimps, all sorts of riffraff in there. So what they did was they shipped the whole lot out, 10,000 people out of this area, and blew it up, set dynamite charges to it. And I never knew about this, but it does sort of lend credence to what you were saying about how the way the French react to Marseille.
Well, we're halfway through re-editing a film where we're looking at Naples, Marseille, and Istanbul, and Gdansk, and the way all those cities, you know, Atatürk, great Turkish nationalist, hated Istanbul.
Yeah.
The Soviet bloc hated, you know, what was going on in Gdansk. And there are specific reasons for that. It's this irregularity of life that goes on. The fact that port cities are open, you know, open-ended. People can come in, but people can also go. So these cities are always in flux. They're never of one identity.
Yeah.
Now, for a nation state, which needs a national identity, the last thing they need is for these comings and goings and identity to be continually in flux. That's why the banner that's portrayed by Liverpool football fans now, you know, we're not English, we are Scouts.
Mm.
We have no desire to be English. And this is why our history is more in common. And I would suggest Bristol's will be as well once the work's done. Has more in common with a world beyond than a world behind. And that's why there are always problems with port cities and their respective nation states. They look outward, not inward.
Mm.
And I think it's what I would like to think and hope is that just as we in Liverpool have started opening these new forms of history that have been hidden from us by very conventional Labour historians, really. The same can be applied to Bristol and to Cardiff, because I think people have asked me before that E.P. Thompson's article, and I know he was famous for writing to rescue from the enormous condescension of posterity. His work in 1967, we have to rescue from the enormous condescension of Labour historians, who it's heavily quoted, and it's heavily quoted all around the world, but no one goes near what E.P. Thompson was asking about. Is there such a thing as a natural work rhythm? If what he's saying is wrong, then let somebody say it's wrong. What is it with women's bodies that does not, you cannot impose industrial discipline on them? If he's wrong with that, let someone say that he's wrong. But no one answers those central points. And of course, his final point was his doubting whether industrial discipline had ever been applied in port cities. Now, if he's wrong on that, we need to know why. But as I say, no one ever goes near it. So we're using that piece of work to start bringing to the surface this new form of history. But it's a history that is tied to freedom. I know we were discussing last night with Peter about the Magna Carta. Well, this is similar, but it's tied to the UN Charter of Human Rights, the UN Charter against Slavery. It says if you're forced to work, that is slavery. Which then takes us into this realm of why is it when a capitalist system goes into crisis, why is it that people on the conventional left dig the system out of the crisis by demanding work and jobs? Now, one of the most embarrassing things for me in the 1980s was being involved in a right to work march and being told by a lot of my members, I don't want to work. I want the right to be born idle, to laze, to create, to be critical, to live a human existence, rather than being just a unit of production. And that's what these issues are about, I believe. You know, this whole question of freedom. What is freedom? Liberty from, liberty to, you know, work, the world of work has got to be central to that. Because as I said before, once, if we continue to see work and that there's a morality attached to it, what do you do with the people who won't work? Labour camps, re-education, no, not good enough. We can't hide that anymore. I did 2 years in Nicaragua in 1988 to 1990. And my last 6 months there, I was horrified. Sandinistas, yeah, I accept they were under a huge amount of pressure. But they'd nationalised the land, but couldn't get anyone to work it. So all the work brigades that went over there, you were automatically put onto agricultural work. And of course the people wouldn't work it one because any alternative that occurred other than agricultural work, they would go to, because they saw that as a form of slavery. Well, fortunately, the last 6 months I was there, the Sandinistas started putting in this operation of educating people for work. No. No, sorry. Doesn't work. Shouldn't work if we're talking about forms of freedom and liberty.
Speaking of educating to work, do you feel that, because I sometimes see that our education system is that education to turn our children into workers. What do you think, see of that?
I think the whole education system, no matter what you do with the system, is geared to failure. And it's geared to failure that, yes, there will be so many allowed through the trap door, but that trap door gets slammed because they've got to have failure, because they've got to be able to tell young people and young kids, you are a failure and there's nothing left for you but working at McDonald's or doing this, or because unless they have failure, who would work the factories and who would do the day-to-day jobs? So then I think it's all geared within that. And when you look at what we would call the philosophy of the morality of work, when you start putting it all together, what's occurring historically as well, from about 1650 onwards, it's always running in tandem with education. You never read any historical documents that talk about educating the poor, because the poor are poor and the only thing left for them is work.
I think it's a really lovely talk. There's a question that I'd like to ask you about, though, which I think is pertinent. See, I always associate in history port cities, industrial cities, with grinding poverty, want, early death, all that sort of thing. And of course, that was all to do with casual labour. So I'd like to know what you think about all that. Is it right? Am I right?
Well, we first decided to have a look at it again when we read E.P. Thompson, and he said, and it's a little note, and he's not making anything fair. He's posing this question. They are no longer. They don't seem to be casualties anymore of what we were told from 1880 onwards. I find it difficult to find, because we've had to do a huge amount of research into what the conventional history was at the time. Now, my trade union degree took on, or I had to write about some of these observers who I thought were telling the truth. And of course, when you look at 1925 in Liverpool, 1933 in particular, there is a major government survey done in conjunction with the Pilgrim Trust, and it's called Men Without Work. And there's a whole chapter on Liverpool casualism. Now, when you reread that chapter, what the author and the government are saying is, the threat is idleness. These people seem to be living a totally irregular life without work, and they don't even want work. Now, when we looked at that, and then we go back and look at the medical and poverty levels, they are all up for debate now. Because I would dispute what previously had been written and what people were writing about. Because it's funny that in 1905, Liverpool is described as this distressed area, but it's never been under European economic rules. It's never been seen as a distressed area. 1905 it was. Poverty ridden, this, that and the other. Yet the Manchester Guardian 2 days later had a whole pull-out on Liverpool girls from the slum. Why are they the well-dressed? Why are they this? Why are they that? There's a huge contradiction to that.
I'm thinking of Jack London, you know, the people of the abyss and all that stuff. That's what I think.
Well, I think we have to go back and relook at what type of, who's describing whom and why.
Mm.
I do. Because all a lot of those writing, the work that was written, there's a strong morality attached to it. That work is good, idleness is bad. Well, you know, you're going back, this is going back to biblical times, really. And I think the people who are viewing it are writing it with that same frame of mind. So I think that all that history is now up for grabs. We need to relook at it all again. Because one of the reasons I think that Liverpool, and whether anyone can tell me about Bristol, why it's been able to deal in the way that it has post-industrial, is that it was never industrial anyway. So the problems in Liverpool pale into insignificance when you move inland. Manchester, Leeds, the heartland of the Industrial Revolution. Enclosed areas, one way in, and there's only one way out. But we're all brought up with that work ethic. When that gets removed, that, you know, there are horrendous problems there. But Liverpool is able to deal with it far better than most, because it was never imbued with that work ethic anyway. And I think that's something important to bear in mind in today's economic climate. That, again, what's interesting, there is a degree of casual work within Liverpool. What worries me is that a trade union would step in and stabilise it, when in fact what is happening from a non-union workforce is the reason the employer is putting wages up now is because there is that amount of mobility out of work. People not lasting more than a week, or shove your job and walk it out. Now, that's another interesting aspect. More and more of these establishments who've relied on casual labour are now finding that they're having to pay way above the minimum rate because their workforce is totally unstable and they need stability. And there is talk of, and I find it quite appalling really, talk of allowing the trade union in to impose a stability on the workforce, which I'm not happy with at all, because I don't think that's a trade union's job.
Good. Steve, you're opening up a whole range of different issues that would be great to talk about, and I'm trying to see in terms of our time and our capacities now, but we'll have some time later on talks together. Let me start with one question, or at least an opening up question. It has to do with work itself, and what you've been, what do you mean by work? Because the concept of work itself has definitely gone through many changes in the last 30 years. First and foremost, we've recognized that an essential aspect of work is that part of human life and human activity, although that it, that it's not waged work is still very much an important part of the way capitalism operates. The work of women who have pointed out that housework has been an essential part of the creation of a capitalist society and has been used and exploited and planned within capitalism, even though, of course, it's without a wage, is an important part of the way in which we understand work now. And similarly, we've begun to discover that the image of work defined by contract, defined according to temporal limits, and so on, that we get in the standard accounts of work, whether Marxist or not, really don't give us a complete sense when we look at any kind of a capitalist society what work that is actually going on. There's a tremendous amount of non-contractual work that's happening. There's a tremendous amount of work that is, in fact, anti-contractual. It's against the law. There's a lot of coerced labor going on. There's a lot of not quite slave, but on the way to slave. So if you look at the notion of work, the idea that you can talk about work as one-dimensional is now gone. Work now is it's a manifold. It has many dimensions. And when you put it that way, it's increasingly difficult to understand what you're saying about a great city like Liverpool, for example, or Naples, because actually I know Naples better than Liverpool. I've never visited Liverpool, I don't know it, but I know Naples, and there's a tremendous amount of work going on in Naples. It's one of the centers of capitalist production on the planet. Although, technically speaking, there's a tremendous amount of unemployment and people are presumably not working. But in fact, they are working. And in fact, they're very much involved with the monetary economy, but it's often called, there's a tremendous amount of what you call criminal labor going on in places like Naples. It's certainly part of an international flow of drugs, an international flow of contraband of all sorts, and people are doing it. Okay, so I have many other things to say in terms of the response to your talk, and I don't want to, but I'd like to open this up, though, first and foremost, to ask you. Yes, I think the E.P. Thompson work is really quite central, and I'm really glad that you're bringing us the attention back to it and saying and seeing that it has lots to say to us today, and so I'm pleased about that. But I would also like to say that there are a lot of things that Thompson did not see about the way work operated. He still had this image, which was still, I suppose, the image that you find in many parts of Marx, which sees work in its very simple way. And once you give that up, then in fact the way time operates in capitalism. There's not only one way in which time is linear, but there's also a circular time in capitalism, right? That's very important to recognize. And there are in fact many dimensions of time, and how capitalism operates with these other dimensions is important for us to understand. Because again, let me just finish up. The way in which Marx, for example, understood the struggle around work was put in terms of the question of the workday, right? And the legislation concerning the workday. And Marx often argued the great historical struggles of the working class have to do with the way in which work and the workday has been increasingly diminished, and capital's response to that diminishing is a central feature of the way Marx understood the class struggle. Okay, that's very important, but that's certainly not the only way in which the working class is struggling against capitalism. That is, reduce the length of the contractual workday. That's not been the only way. There's been a tremendous number of other ways in which the class struggle has taken place. So I'd like to just pose that to you so that we might begin, not now, because I think we've been gone for a while on this matter, but I'd like to just say, well, what do you think about this question of work, since it's so central to your analysis?
we're doing a huge work amount of work now on the informal economy.
Okay.
To an extent, that Liverpool was awarded the European Capital of Culture 2008. We were asked to put together some papers for a port city conference. But such is the disaster that is Liverpool Capital of Culture, the company's more or less bankrupt now. They were unable to put on this particular event.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to speak about the informal economy, amongst other things. They finally received funding from Interpol. And wanted me to stand in front of a group of
that's great, I love it.
To actually explain to them the illicit nature of Liverpool's informal economy.
Oh boy.
Whether it's drugs, smuggling, blah-de-blah.
How much did you get for it?
No, I have declined the offer.
Oh, okay.
But
you reduced your work day.
The day, what's interesting is yeah, it's the informal economy. That's what we're interested in. Edward Thompson said, when people are in control of their own time, this natural work rhythm will apply to writers, artists, some self-employed. So yeah, we're looking at levels of self. People working for themselves, doing whatever, illegal and otherwise. That is where we're looking at that on the one hand. We're running in tandem to that, this whole question of work evasion.
Mm-hmm.
Why Liverpool still has the lowest productivity rates in all of the country. And that's why we celebrated getting the European Capital of Culture. Not the English Capital of Culture, the European. Because what was interesting was the day that it started, January the 8th, 2008, unbeknownst to them, the local paper, with that on the headline and say hello to Ringo Starr. But when you read the evening paper, on every page, there had been a major drug find, levels of council tax evasion, we're at record levels, record of non-payments of fines, blah. And the final, on the final page, a report had come out to say, Liverpool, work is bad for your health. And we couldn't have put it better. A European capital of non-work culture. That's how we see it. But all these, it's the irregular economy we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Work evasion, casualism is far more difficult because the safety net that was applied on the docks and at sea in the 1930s and 1940s is no longer there. What is there is the original casualism of we ring you at 5 o'clock in the morning and if you're not here we'll sack you. Well, all those, that's what we're back to really. But we're keeping an open mind on it in terms of, well, one point that we're clear on is that when this capitalist economy, whatever type of economy it is, goes into crisis, it is always the left that digs us out by demanding the right to work and jobs. Unemployment's terrible. Now there are for people, I know for a fact, unemployment is difficult. But we cannot apply that model where every major cultural revolution seems to occur around the world in times of high levels of unemployment. I don't think we can get away from that. Maybe enforced leisure leads to some kinds of the creative juices.
Oh, okay. Well, that's one way of. Let's put it this way: the notion of creative juices, the notion that, in other words, we have another measure at work here, right? So one is the measure of profit, and the other is that's one measure, the capitalist measure. And then you're saying that we should have another measure of the functioning of a society in this period of history, which will tell us whether, in fact, it's productive of higher levels of culture. Is that? Oh, I see. Okay. But now, who's going to make that decision?
Well, I don't think it's up to anyone to make the decision. Okay. I think if we just look at, you know, areas where there's been huge cultural explosions, you know, punk in this country exploded at a time of high levels of youth unemployment. Now, did it explode because people were demanding to be employed and that was their form of protest? Or was it a form of protest of being put back to work in terms of youth opportunity schemes and this type of thing?
It's an interesting study, but remember, your most famous cultural product, right? Let's call it the Beatles, okay? If we have to return back to it. They come from the period of basically British Keynesianism, in the period of the early 60s. And in fact, they call themselves after the car of Keynesianism, actually Nazi form of Keynesianism, the Beatles, right? The mass-produced instrument of pleasure that the working class is finally able to accomplish, right?
I disagree, George. All that, throughout the four families, were all from the great ranks of Liverpool casual labour, seafarers and dockers.
No. Perhaps that's true. You're going to tell me.
There was not a regular worker. And in fact, their musical skills were owned by their mothers, who were the major creative forces. No. So in a way, the Beatles are the epitome, even though I loathe them.
They satisfy your thesis, so. Okay.
Right, I've had enough of this work. Do you mind if I sit down?